accession number 20729, reel 5.
Harry Smith, reel 3.
Good.
Right, you're back to Canberra's.
Yeah. I was just mentioning, though, when I was at Wittering, you know, the 49th Squadron was the squadron that went out and did all those, dropped all the H-bombs at Christmas Island. So I know quite a few guys that were on there, you know, that's called Pringle, who dropped 2 bombs. I think he's the only man in the world who's ever dropped 2. He was a co-pilot of them, but two of them.
What was the situation at Wittering? I mean, you had nuclear weapons stored there, didn't you?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, did you know much about that?
No, we used to go. Well, there was a little course you could go up to there, where they stored them, and they'd give a little lectures and things, you know. There was also an ordinary bomb dump as well. No, it was all very, full of a one-off, you know, never really got involved with it at all. I saw the big bomb come out once and dragged to the aeroplane and...
Was that the free-fall bomb?
That was the free-fall one, yes. And then later on, I think, they used to do trials with them, did they?
On Salisbury Plain?
Yes, but actually fly with them on board and surveillance round. Everybody was always quite concerned when there was one airborne with a bomb weapon on board, you know. Just
a real live weapon?
And, and they were doing trials of whether what they were doing, I don't know. But people would... this is when I was in the headquarters bomber, you see, I was... In the operations room, they'd always have a take an interest that this thing was up there, you know, for obvious reasons, really. Mm. In case there was a problem, it didn't seem to ever be one.
Yeah.
But
wonderful story. I think it's mentioned in this book about aerodynamic circumstances when bombs were often released, that they would sort of fly along with the aircraft. Did you ever come across
I've been thinking about what you said before. There was one or two incidents with bombs. There was a practice bomb we had on board once that 100-pounder, and it didn't release when we were, and so all we did was, you know, switch it off, close the bomb doors, and then about 10 minutes later, this damn thing, there was a bit of a thump, and it had obviously fallen off the hook. Mm. And whether it was an ice stop up there or whatever, I don't know. And we looked at one another, you know, and would have been all right. I mean, because it had to, when you dropped it, it had to... It had a fan on it which armed it. But I think we landed quite gently and braked gently rather than it might slide along. And sure enough, it was on, and we lifted up the deflector plate at the back, and sure enough, it was sitting there on the doors, you know. So that was the only thing. And I'll say there was one or two incidents of... there was one out in Suez, I believe, where I came back from a raid, a real raid with 1,000, and it appeared to be a hang-up, as they called it, on the 1224 way. The flag was there, and it was night time, and somebody opened the deflector plate, and he looked in and said, "Oh, no, it's gone, it's all clear," you know. So they thought, right, pushing buttons and trying to get rid of this flag, and it's ridiculous, you know, it was obviously the mechanism wrong, so they got another 1224 way, plugged it in, and sure enough, the flag came off again. Why was it coming off? Because there was a bomb still there. So they've been trying to clear the, you know, jettison, and the bomb was still there. They'd missed it, you know, by looking in with a torch. So these are the silly things that happen, don't they, with a panic. No, I haven't heard of that one. I can't recall it.
Anyhow, you went back to Canberra flying.
Yeah.
And that was what, for radar calibration?
Yes, it was a bit boring. It was just, some of it, mainly, it was just me making a blip, really, you know, for radars and things like this. started to all go a bit pear-shaped then. I didn't, I didn't feel as if I'd made much progress. I'd go back to where I was a few years before, as a 21-year-old, and I, it wasn't a bad outfit, really, but...
Can you remember the name of the unit or the number?
Oh, yes, 98 Squadron at Watton. Yeah, quite an enjoyable... you got away from the... we didn't seem to fly as crews then, just pick up a nav, and quite a lot of experience around. And
what mark of Canberra was it?
B2 again.
Oh, B2 again?
Yes.
Not the BA or anything?
No. And, some good trips you could go. We went out to quite a long way, actually, out to the Indian Ocean in the Canberra calibrating...
out to Cairn or somewhere like that?
Yeah, the Takan, see? At, not Gan, no, never got spot. What's that island off the east coast? No, it's not there anymore now.
No.
I believe it's...
Seychelles.
Seychelles. No. No, not far. Oh, goodness. I'll have to look
Gan
in the book,
you see.
Was
the big station,
yeah, it's...
Tell me about your trip to Aden.
Yes, we went to Aden to, for them, they, I think, whether there was a threat from the north or something, I don't know, but they put this big air defence radar in. Two aircraft went, two of us went out there to make blips for it, basically, line astern, But the temperatures out there in a B2, my God, fathers, it's a... You didn't know what to do because it was so hot. Mm. So their solution, the command was, go at dawn and before the sun comes up. But the temperatures are just the damn same at night. It's really is
humid.
They
haven't even fitted air conditioning in all those years.
No, that's what the wing commander was. We're always moaning about temperatures. Take records of temperatures in the cockpit, on the ground and in the air, look at these damn temperatures. Well, I think it was quite a major modification to get this Godfrey cold air unit in, and always threatening to do it, but never quite.
Because the Italian had air conditioning.
Yes, and all the later marks of the of the Canberras and the T4s did, But these B2s, God. But I really was... It was, we went out there, and this camp, people would talk about it, even in Malta, the sweat would be, as you took off the acceleration, they'd put all this sweat and go into their eyes, And the object of the exercise was to get in and get to the master, and airborne as fast as you can, And this thing at Aden, you've got the air conditioning, they had a big air conditioning unit outside. And it'd be shoved inside the cockpit while you were doing your checks, But then you've got this double bubble canopy with the, when the sun's going to get there. And then you take this pipe out and shut the door, and then it was a rush to get airborne, But you couldn't stop sweating. And the trouble was, you had to try and think about if you were any length at 40,000 feet, you'd be freezing, So you'd be drenched in sweat with what we called a bunny suit on, a woolen suit. And of course, when you got up there, you're like this, And all I can recall was doing this flight, absolutely freezing. And the engineer that was on the ground said, if you can get one more run in, that'll be it, we won't have to fly again tomorrow. Okay then. So we came back, and eventually he said, okay, that's it. And I throttled back and spiralled down all the way down to the airfield at Colmaxa, it was. And landed, it was all steaming up because he couldn't get down quick enough, So temperatures of, 104 or something. And then I got out, and... signing, everybody else was stripping off, and I was still cold, you know, looks peculiar, I thought so. So I signed up and I said, what's the matter with you? I said, I don't know. They said, you know. So I went back, they decided to go downtown or something. And I got into bed, switched off the fan, still shaking. And what it was, I got hypothermia, really. That's what you see. I got cold soaks. And I felt like death warmed up. I mean, like, I actually thought I got the flu coming on. You know, it was just like that, you know. And I was still as weak as a kitten in the evening, you know. And I got it still damp cold. Went and tried to have a little milk. Didn't fancy anything to eat. But, you know, this was the shock to the body of these extremes of cold and heat. Oh, dear. Oh, they were dreadful. I mean, that damn... See, the Americans, when they built the camera, they had an open...
Yeah.
They, you know, opened up to the atmosphere. But this B2, oh, goodness me, was cold. It made life miserable, really. I mean, I liked flying the aircraft, but the last thing you wanted to be in it was for 3.5 hours at 40,000 feet, you know?
Yeah.
Medium level, that was no problem.
Now, the end of the Valiant, were you around when they started scrapping?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was at Watton by this time, and I gathered there'd been a bit of an incident, which they were a bit unsure about caused it. But I understand that what actually happened to seal its fate was an aircraft took off from somewhere. There was a hell of a thump, you know, when it got airborne. And this guy thought, what the hell is that, you see? And decided to come back, land, tried to lower the flaps, and they wouldn't go down. So he did a flapless landing and, you know, as you do, put something in the book. And then the story goes that somebody says, come out and have a look at this. And mate's bar's gone, broken, and moved back about a foot and disconnected the flaps, and that's why they wouldn't go down. But the only thing that was keeping the wing on was the skin. If he'd have pulled up half a G, you know, the wing would have fell off. So that caused it, you can imagine. Caused it, but now I don't know the ramifications from then on. They tried to do little bits of trials or whatever and tried to not overstrain the air. I mean, little did we know all that time that, you know. Well, it was some sort of a manufacturing flaw or they were suspect, these spars, you see. And the thought of to re-spar them would have cost a fortune, that sort of thing. And I understand that somebody said, well, scrap them. And that's what they did. I mean, literally took the engines out and they say, bar them, and just bulldozed them into scrap.
Yeah, yeah.
And people were crying and, you know, crew chiefs had been there for years. And
yeah.
So... What, there was an aeroplane worth millions, and all of a sudden, you know, that we looked after was rubbish. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know who took the decision. I mean, it's a big
well,
decision.
Well, by that time, you had the Vulcan and the Victory.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. Aeroplane. Exactly. Oh, exactly. And, exactly.
More high performance.
Yes, I don't know. I don't know what happened to the... there was talk at one time, I understand, of making a Mark II Valiant, you know, but it never...
The Mark II did fly.
Did it?
The black one.
Oh, yes.
That was designed for low level, but...
Yeah.
There's a picture of it there, I think.
Was it the low level that was knocking him to hell, do you think?
It was, yes.
Oh.
I think because once Gary Powers got shot down, they realised that the V-bombers were vulnerable at altitude.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They started this high-low-high business,
yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
And that's at the time then they knew. I think they knew the air wasn't doing the airframes much good. And this is why they were trying to limit the number of hours that people were flying. You needed just to keep your hand in, more or less.
Yeah.
But I said, I think people were still flogging them to death, you know.
I interviewed some years ago the chap who designed the electrical system on the Valiant. And the Valiant,
yes,
was an all-electric aeroplane, wasn't it?
Yes.
mean, exactly. What were your memories of that? Was it
very good, very good. See, what we found very reassuring about it at the time was it the power controls, you know, with the air, but he had what they call manual reversion. If you lost all power controls, you could still, it was very heavy, but you could still operate it like an old-fashioned
aeroplane.
Pardon?
It's like power steering on a car.
Yes, quite. Really heavy. But yeah. Without power steering, exactly.
Yeah.
But it was nice and reassuring that, you know, if you lost all your electrical power and hydraulic manual power controls, you could revert to what was manual, you know, revert to manual. Do you remember, has anybody talked about of the Valiant that did lose all its electrical power and crashed? Mm. The bloke called Priest was the co-pilot. It was that was nasty. They were doing trial somewhere with some electrical gear. And this thing had a circuit breaker, and it wasn't working. So they're doing the trial, and this AO, whoever he was, some bloody idiot, kept trying to reset this circuit breaker, and it kept popping. And I think story goes, he pushed it, he held it in, and he blew all four HRC fuses to the four generators.
Generators on each engine.
But unfortunately, the wiring was such that the lights didn't come on. So they were flying along with no power, no hydro, nothing, and was running on this one battery, on the battery, which, of course,
gradually flattened.
Drained out. They had nothing to work then. Mm. And he got the rear crew members out, I think. They bailed out, you know, through the door, and the co-pilot him, and they got out. But
there was a dead lump of metal by that time.
Well, there was a funny way of, you know, that these damn lights were wired through the system. You know, it makes sense that there'd be no warning. You know, that the lights never come up. Mm. Just this, the condition of the battery was, you know, and
they lost a Vicar for the same reason.
Yeah.
I remember reading it. Flying from the Channel Islands. And of course, they all went into the sea. There's no way they could get out.
Yeah.
They were left on the battery, and just the aircraft just died in the air.
Yeah. I don't know. What was the? I think it was enough. You see, it was back to manual reversion. Couldn't use the trim or something.
So if you lose all your electrics anyway, you've lost all your fuel pumps and.
Yeah, there was another incident. How stupid can he get? This guy, after this, same guy, a bit quick on the uptake after that.
Yeah.
And he was flying along. When you came to do your stint, relieve yourself, the captain or the first officer could take the stick out of the way. So you pull a little knob here.
Yeah.
And the stick would unlock, and it would go out of the way, so you could have your soap and sandwiches and whatever. And then when you wanted to fly again, you'd pull it back. You didn't have to, and it clicked in automatically. But if you turned this knob, you know, it was permanently unlocked. And the story goes, this guy somewhere or other, who was in some incident or other, he'd let the stick go forward, and then taking it over from the first officer and got it back. It was well trimmed. So he didn't realise he was engaged. And then all of a sudden, he went like this, you see. And the bloody thing wasn't working. And then he jumped, you know, jumped to the conclusion that he hadn't got control and started to bail people out and things. And rear crew members jumped out and all sorts. Eventually, I think it was sorted out. The guy... Nothing wrong with it, so if he'd pull this thing back, you know, he'd have been back in business, but he disconnected it, so he hadn't, you know.
Yeah.
The silly things like that do happen, don't they? Right?
So you came out of the RAF in 68?
Yeah, I came out at 38. I did 17 years. 17. Oh, look, pension.
1968, yeah.
Mm, a pension. You know, not all that great. And I commuted that and whatever. And this is nothing to do with the service, but then I was most unhappy. I didn't know what. I eventually got a job in Birmingham, my old hometown. What the hell I was doing there, I don't know. Some factory or other. And I was supposed to be the assistant production manager. And within a few weeks, I was the production manager, you know. And my boss was having a mental breakdown and so on. And I didn't know what I was doing. I was
supposed to. What factory was this?
Tube products in a grotty old place. I've got my nice, reasonable house at Sutton Coalfield, but and they sent me on a course, a management course at Coventry for a few months. You know, the money wasn't too bad, but it was the most talk about the most old, dirty old factory you ever did see. And the managing director was, I believe, trying to get some new blood in. You know. And I was one, and there was a submariner, submarine man. There was another, he was just coming out of the Navy, and he was with me on these. And we didn't know how we could win, you know, but nobody wanted to know what we were doing. And we were like on another planet, you know. I don't know whether you know, if you spend all that time in the services, you've got slang and, you know, it's... You don't know what to go at. People have said to me, like, what's your national insurance number? And, you know, have you got a health card? Like, have you got a stamp? You just remember the stamps where you put stamps on for? Have you got your... Well, I don't know what you mean. I've never had one. You know what I mean? They look at it as if you're daft, you know. What? Everybody's got a stamp card, you know, where you put stamps on. Well, I haven't. You know, it's like it's the most amazing feeling, and I must tell you, I was thinking about going when the captain left the service. I was thinking of going to civil aviation. Unfortunately, my hearing is not all that good now, not too bright, and I did the John Cass course in London, you know, for civil to get the ALTP or the civil license, and then I went to the medical. And things were not doing so well, I think. British Eagle had closed and civil aviation was in the doldrums, you know. And I'm 38 with three kids. And the doctor said to me, he said, well, your hearing is good enough to get a license, he said. But you'll find that British Airways and all that, he said, I've got a much higher standard than the minimum requirement. You'll find yourself, I said, I think. Try to get a job, you know. So I thought, well, I could spend an awful lot of money, you know, trying to get this civil license. And so this is when I decided I'll try something else, and I went to this factory business, you see, in a manager or something. What I was supposed to be doing, I don't know. I had about 160 men, believe it or not, forming them. And I got on well with them, no trouble. I used to go in there every day and chat them up, and you know, I never had any trouble with the guys. Well, what I was supposed to do management wise, I never did quite, you know, not going down too well. I used to go and have a chat, and but
I mean, your life had been so organized, yeah.
Of course.
And then you come
well,
out,
you come out. To well, you've got yourself. You've got the medical services and dentists, and you know, food, and it's just. Your social life exists really in the bar and the odd dance, and you know what I mean. And all of a sudden, I was so desperately unhappy. I had gone back again quickly, you know.
What did your wife think about it when you came?
Oh, she took it in a stride. She's a dour sort of character. But what to get to the nitty gritty after about a year or so of this, I was picked up the air clues. You know, and I looked in there, and there was a simulator instructor required at Oxford Air Training School. And I packed it up by now. I'd given a notice. I just didn't know what I was in. You know, I had to work basically. And it's a chap called Peter Terry, my boss. I met him the other week. You know, lovely fella. And I said, you know, he said, yeah, come down and. And I told him where I was living. Sutton Coalfield. He said, my grandfather, he said, you'll see a Peter Terry Grammar School up the road. And I said, yeah, that's right. He said, that's where my grandfather ran that school, grammar school. So I said, oh, yeah. So anyway, I came down to Oxford, and it was like home for all. There was all these Air Force guys in the simulator, and, you know, I'm very experienced guys, a Czech guy and whatever. And he showed me around, and he never even looked at my hours. I mean, I could have been Mickey Mouse. He never looked at the book or nothing. No. And he said, yeah, what do you think? So I said, yeah, and I said, yeah. He said, I said, yeah. He said, hey, you can come. He said, what about starting January the 1st, you see, for there? And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll start December the 1st, because it was, you know. And yeah, okay, he said. And it was just like coming home, it was. And I stopped up at the monastery and up at the airport for a while, getting a room up there. I used to come home on Friday lunchtime, go back on Monday while I was, my wife was still living in Birmingham. And I looked around this place, you know, looking for somewhere to live. A 20-minute ride to Oxford Airport, beautiful ride, trees and, you know, no problem. Park right outside the door. And I'm looking for somewhere to live, and I found a Chalbury, you know, a house up the road. And money wasn't all that good, but couldn't care less. Do you know what I mean? I really felt I'd had that 18 months of horrible life in that factory that it you know, I didn't care what happened. It was really pleasant. I wandered down the river down here, and I thought, this will suit me, you know. And I stopped there for, till I retired, 60 to 62 and a half, you know.
Fantastic.
I had a tremendous time. I mean, I was there for 1970, you see. I did about 22 years up there.
On the simulator?
Oxford Air
Training, wasn't it?
Air Training, yeah. But the boss was a smashing guy, and the bloke after him was great as well, you know. Mm. And I really did enjoy it, really. I mean, you know, we had a crew room where we used to drink coffee. Just like the Air Force. More like the Air Force than the Air Force. I mean, you know what I mean? Amazing.
That's a fantastic story, Harry. I think we'll probably draw
a line
over there.
It's
terrific. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.